Poetry on the Radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two episodes with Anne M. Carson. Plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events around Canberra. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Anne M. Carson is a Melbourne-based poet, visual artist and essayist. Last week we spoke to her about her books, including The Detective's Chair, Liquid Amber Press 2023, her series of poems about fictional detectives and the light that detective work throws on poetic practice. We also talked about her 2019 book from Ginninderra Press, Two Green Parrots. Along with winning several honours for her poetry, Anne M. Carson has mounted poetry-led projects for social justice causes. In today's program, we'll hear more about Massaging Himmler. And later, we'll hear about Anne M. Carson's project in her PhD work at RMIT, a poetic biography of George Sand. During the last part of last week's program, Anne M. Carson told us about her Massaging Himmler, a poetic biography of Dr. Felix Kirsten, Hybrid Publishers 2019, which is about a masseur who managed to free many prisoners in Nazi Germany. Today she begins by setting the context of the poetic history. Here's its opening.
Felix talks about snakes beneath the bed. National Socialist Headquarters, Chancellery, Berlin, 1939. Think physiotherapy, massage, clinical white sheet words, washed hands, nails nicely groomed. The bed is made up, white sterilized towels, cotton coverlet, anodyne atmosphere, hushed voices, healing hands. No place for passion, poison. His bed is a divan pressed up against the wall, a dark room with solid wooden furniture. Woolen blankets are brown as boot polish, Spartan, masculine. He sleeps here between duties when he cannot make it home or to his mistress, or when his guts are so badly spasmed it is all he can do to stay conscious, maintain his grip on the reins of power. I don a white treatment coat, but may as well not bother for all the protection it offers. Beneath the bed is a nest of vipers, venomous, virile. They breed so quickly, hundreds of hatchlings, scores of adults in a Medusa mess. They writhe and gripe, twine round the bed legs, slither up to me, fangs out, tasting air. You think this is metaphor? This is about halfway through the book. Felix's journal entries, May 1943. Luck is with me. H is greatly afflicted. His normal resistance, like his body, collapsed in on itself. He readily agrees to everything I ask. I save 14 Dutch condemned to death. Yesterday it was 3 Estonians, 2 Letts, 6 Dutch and 1 Belgian. The day before I obtained pardon for 42 Dutch facing execution. The Nazis are meticulous with figures. Work in units of tens, hundreds, tens of thousands of people. My scale is tiny, my work piecemeal. Only perseverance.
In such a long book, why did you choose that poem?
I wanted something that showed what he did, how he did it, how he approached it, that it was this very piecemeal thing. Towards the end of the war, he facilitated actions that saved many thousands of people in one fell swoop. But sort of day to day, that's what he was doing, sort of chipping away by a prisoner here, a prisoner there. It started because a friend of his factory foreman had been arrested for being a social democrat, and Kirsten was outraged, and Himmler said to him, "I've never paid you for your massage. I want to pay you." And Kirsten knew that if he accepted payment, he lost an opportunity. So he said no. And then he remembered that this friend had told him about the social democrat foreman. And he said, but I've got a, you know, you could do something for me. A friend has lost his factory form, and he was only a social democrat. And so this was the first one, and it was sort of like a test case. Mm. And Himmler sort of paused, and then he said, because it's you asking, my friend, yes, I'll do it. And so he started out with, you know, quite a few people, this friend and that friend, and he started out just saying they were his friends, and slowly it morphed into, they obviously weren't his friends anymore, but he was advocating, and Himmler allowed it.
What an unusual circumstance to find oneself in. But if you think about the really, really big picture, I mean, I'm sure it felt piecemeal, and then a structure, an organization that powerful and well run, piecemeal is probably the only way to subvert.
I think that's right.
The organization of it. But if you think about it from the really big picture about lineage and progeny, he's probably saved so many more because people live to
that's
have
right,
children.
Exactly. And at the very end of the war, he organized one of the most extraordinary meetings in history, which always gives me goosebumps, between Himmler and a representative of the World Jewish Congress. And they went to his country estate, Kirsten's country estate. And the order had come from Hitler to blow up the concentration camps. And so Kirsten and some others were also working to try and get that not translated. And so this meeting was set up to try and persuade Himmler to not follow through with that. And they were successful. Mm-hmm. And so he set up this meeting. He contributed to that. And that enabled people to come back from the concentration camps. It's an amazing, amazing action. And many people contributed, but he set up that meeting.
And that's one of those things about history, you know, when we're given a narrative, think about how many people know about the Holocaust and but don't know about that bit. And I think that's the details that taking a historical, biographical approach via poetry enables, because it sort of changes the shape of the narrative, right? It's no longer linear, or it's no longer progressive in a way that prose or a more traditional historical narrative might. It opens it up, right? In a way, you have a persona as well, and the poet has to navigate the voice as much as the details, and it's a very whole.
Yeah, yeah, it gives a poet the freedom for great flexibility, I think, and it really gives the freedom particularly to imagine this personality and try and bring a personality alive. Mm-hmm. And of course you want to do your research, you want that to be sort of growing out of solidly researched fact, and I feel confident that mine did. And then there's a person, you know, and you can speak from that person's point of view, you can have them think and feel things that affect a reader in a very visceral and immediate way that prose biographers, they don't have that option. Yeah, so that's very interesting. And it was Arno Kirsten, his son, read the book. English isn't his first language, but he read it and he was amazed. He'd never read any poetry and he didn't think he'd be able to get it. But because he knows the story so well, he got it and he's endorsed it, which is a lovely, I mean, you know, I would have done my own thing anyway. It wasn't that I needed his imprimatur, but I love having it.
Next, Anne M. Carson tells us about a book she wrote during her many years of preparing Massaging Himmler, influenced in part by her mother's interest in bird twitching, Two Green Parrots, Ginninderra Press, 2019.
I was sort of primed in my love of birds by my mother. She was a twitcher, and that's someone who actually travels around with her bird book, and she sought to see the highest variety of birds and tick them off as she saw them. Yeah. So I inherited her bird book and her binoculars. I don't tend to do it like that, but she primed me. You know, she sort of alerted me to them as beings. And then when I became a poet, I just, of course, gravitated to writing about them because they're beautiful to watch. They're so clever in how they conduct their lives with, you know, how they make amazing nests with their beaks.
Right.
Many different aspects impressed me and got my imagination going. Mm. They're such a great symbol.
Mm.
You don't want to reduce them to a symbol because they exist in their own right. And as a symbol, you can sort of jump over ecological threats to their existence. And we don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. But there is a level at which they represent things that many humans aspire to, like the flight of imagination or being elevated by something. There's one poem I wrote about watching a couple of parrots fly into a storm. It's a title poem. Two green parrots. Two green parrots wing across a granite sky. Grief and hope together again, as close as fingers on a hand, feathers on a wing. They don't fly straight as arrows do into a standing target. They are not ammunition fired out of the sky's maw. They dip and rise, weaving muscle and delight into strands of effortless grace, calling as they go. What do humans know of the calls of birds? But it sounds like liquid pleasure. It sounds like they laugh and make merry against the backdrop of the approaching storm.
That's that imaginative leap again that you often do at the end. The approaching storm is just, it's so abstract, but we're so ready to make that leap.
Because that's great.
All of our senses from the poem are alert, right? The sounds and the imagery. And then we just go with you.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's one of the great offerings of lyric poetry, being able to, I don't know, demonstrate or explore the human in the world, mm-hmm. you know, interrelating with the world. And whether it's in the observation of birds or in seeing the symbolism that birds might play, being the witness to the birds. I love that combination of the imaginative and the grounded. Yeah, I guess that's one of my hallmarks in a way.
Anne M. Carson has written many poems about birds and also about trees and other natural phenomena. As we mentioned last week, among organisations and causes she has assisted with poetry-led social justice projects have been the River Keepers and the Carbon Neutral Charity Fund.
Gone. The mother tree, and the epigraph is its name, golden ash, Fraxinus excelsior aurora. Under the arms of the silver birch, I find another diminutive forest of golden ash seedlings, a spreading bonsai understory taken root. I pull them out one after the other, feeling the stem's wiry strength, the moment of grip before release, how life hangs on. They colonise all corners of the garden, any foothold offering purchase. Every few weeks, more miniature plantations, another crop hidden under seaside daisies, by the acanthus clump. Only since the mother tree came down, not before. How do they know? It was not the tree's fault that the neighbour's storm water masqueraded as underwater watercourse, pulling roots irresistibly. Fault or not, the tree was felled. Not how they used to bring trees down, battle with worthy adversary, necessity of brute strength, then the dreadful glory of an almighty crash, sound ringing out through the forest, sound commensurate with act. This is piecemeal dismemberment with no honour in it. I can hardly watch. The night before the loppers arrive, I go out for farewell, for warning. As if the tree could suck its life force back into the earth somehow, protect itself from the chainsaw's teeth. I put palms to bark, rest my forehead against strength. Acquiescence to the inevitable. I grieve for the grandeur of the tree, gift of cool summer canopy, arabesque of arms in winter, palette of coloured leaves painted on autumn sky. The offspring are charged with the challenge of life. Months passed, still they slip periscopes through soil, reaching for life. And when I'm not looking, they unfurl another green banner.
That poem has such, for me, such grief in it. And then at the fear of sounding a little cliched, you know, the hope at the end. One poem runs this full spectrum of human feeling, and it's through this single tree.
Mm. It's so interesting, isn't it, how life and your experiences sort of bleed into your work. And that was not long after Mum died. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a whole series of poems of about her and trees. That poem wasn't explicitly about her, but I always knew that calling it the mother tree was sort of indicative that it wasn't just, like, I did have profound grief for the loss of that tree because it really wasn't its fault, but it couldn't be argued with. So there was grief for the tree, but I knew that grief for my mother was bleeding into that, and that poem sort of is infused with it. So it's interesting that you feel it so strongly.
The last thing I wanted to talk about in terms of two green parrots is that the United States comes in at the most unexpected moment. The poem with Huckleberry in it, which is about the Mississippi River, it was incredible to me reading this because here you are, an Australian poet, and your experience of seeing the Mississippi River for the first time was very much like mine. Huh? Where I couldn't believe how massive it was. And I love the word huckleberry. What a great word that is.
Isn't it?
Right.
That was really interesting because the cause or the prompt to go to the States was that my husband had died a couple of years before. And so my previous book was writing about that. Mm. And then I wanted to share that work, the sequence of poems about his death. And so I got connected with a thanatology conference, which is a conference of people who assist people in the dying process. And so it was counsellors and social workers, etc. And I put a proposal together that they really needed the arts and they really needed poetry. And wouldn't this be a great way to, you know, open up the idea of thanatology and maybe poetry could help grieving people like it had helped me in writing. And I was accepted. Poem without Huckleberry in it. The first thing I recognise of America is a wide ribbon of Pewter River spreading across the patchwork quilted squares of farmer-tilled land below. It has to be the Mississippi, I think, my first glimpse of a US icon. 33,000 feet above, and the river is so broad it takes up so much space in the small oval eye of the plain. It has to be kilometres across. Sinuous, undulant, a cascading, dull, silver-hued radiance thrown across the country, like a thick thread of twisted metal appliqued onto cloth. Someone has thrown the spool from somewhere up north, Canada maybe, or Minnesota, and the ribbon has unravelled all the way down the length of the land, weaving through the middle states, coming finally to the Gulf of Mexico, where the reel runs out.
Another aspect of Anne M. Carson's poetic practice is exploring the uses of poetry in therapy.
I think often writing about episodes in your life, occasions that are challenging, can be very therapeutic. And it's another thing entirely to turn that cathartic, personal cathartic experience into something that is available to other people, mm. suitable for other people. Mm. So I'm always mindful of that. You know, of course, lyric poetry is grounded in the personal. And in many of my poems, I do include that. And I sort of look at it as, is the poem remaining just facing the writer, or has it turned around that it is for a wider audience? And not all poems are, I think. Mm. So that's one thing. But I did actually work as a creative writing therapist when I was working at a neighbourhood house for a number of years. And it was one of the most satisfying parts of my professional life because our main thing was supporting parents of kids on the spectrum. It was a creative writing project to assist the parents in processing the whole range of challenges they'd had in receiving a diagnosis, providing the care that their child needed, etc. And none of them were writers, so it was assisting them to tell their story and for their own cathartic purposes in the group, and then to shape it into a way that made it sort of publishable into a book.
Right.
And so we did this, I think, three times, and each time it was just absolutely fantastic as someone who was sort of presiding over, assisting in that process. And we also did it for a group of homeless people, which was slightly different. It wasn't them telling their them writing their story, but them telling us their story and then in consultation with them forming a written account of that. So all of those projects of explicit sort of therapy I've loved, and when I finish my current study, I'd love to return to that because I think there's so much scope to assist community health in passing on the skills of writing and the therapeutic and cathartic possibilities in literature.
Anne M. Carson's current project is a poetic biography of Georges Sand, the 19th century Romantic era French novelist and pioneer feminist thinker. Born Amantine Lucille Aurore Dupin, as Georges Sand, she wrote more than 90 novels, 24 plays, masses of journalism, and an estimated 40,000 letters, and influenced and was admired by such authors as Victor Hugo, Gustave Flaubert, George Eliot, and Walt Whitman. She was a close companion of Chopin before she fell from prominence. Anne M. Carson uses archival, historical, and biographical methods, as well as informed imagination, to evoke Sand's life. Here's Carson at the Poetry on the Move Festival in September 2022. As of that point, she had written over 150 poems for the project. Many, she explained, were set at the estate Sand had inherited.
A roar on the rack. I am on a rack. My small girl's body stretches between my two great beloveds, Mama and Grandmama. They each hold fast to a hand, vying for control. Who will leave their mark on me? To whom will I give allegiance? Class warfare within the small orbit of the home, the smaller confine of my body. Sometimes they cooperate and I am blessed, the luckiest girl in the world with two doting mamas. But it never lasts and I am back on the rack. This one belittles that one, the other also sticks in the dagger. My heart bleeds at each dagger thrust. Who should I defend? Sand started writing before she changed her name, but once she started writing in earnest, she had a practice of writing between midnight and 3 a.m. or later every day. She set herself a minimum number of pages to complete, and apart from sickness and relationship breakup, she kept to it for her whole professional life. And the word cree-cree in this next poem is the name of her pet cricket. A roar describes writing in the small hours, 1831, Noong. These hours I like so very much, deep silence, sonorous as a bell, toll, toll, tolling me to my desk and my hours of labour and delight. Scrabble and scrape, hoot and screech, companioned by the industry of owls, cree-crees chirp, sounds I add to the night, scratch of my quill, riffling of my papers, when I strike a match. The author reflects on Georges Sand's novels. as innocuous looking as the jubes and jellies ladies enjoyed nibbling. French ladies devoured them in salons across the country, sitting on chaise by the fire. German ladies read them in Wohnzimmers. Even across the channel, blushing English ladies read them in drawing rooms with pots of tea steaming. Aristocratic Russian ladies, samovars on standby, could not get enough of them. Nothing for husbands or senses to worry about. Brought into the home, that most contested domain. Sometimes even husbands themselves picked up copies on their way back. A slow burn, instalment by instalment, in journals innocently left on occasional tables and bureaus, scattered around chateaux, manor houses, estates, dachas, cottages, for all to see. Everyone agreed it was good for ladies to have something to do while husbands worked, servants ran the home, and children studied with tutors. Sand never passed up the opportunity of packing dynamite into simple love stories, sweet pastoral tales, rousing utopian novels. Heroines and heroes ready to explode convention, narrow-mindedness, discrimination. Under the cover of divertissement, warrior ideas, ready to leap out, open the gates. Like the Trojans, whoever saw it coming?
Today and on last week's episode, our visitor has been Anne M. Carson. Next week, we'll speak with Penelope Leyland and Leslie Lebkowitz, the editors of a new anthology, Book of Birds, from Recent Work Press. I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle, on Monday, September 18 at Smith's Alternative in Civic, as part of that poetry thing, Recent Work Press presents two poets with new collections, preceded by an open mic. Ez Fung, a.k.a. Waffle Iron Girl, is a poet, flash fictionista and spoken word performer. Brendan Ryan's six collections of poetry include The Lowlands of Moyne, Wallea Press, 2019. And here's advance word that on September 25, Monday at Smith's, 7 p.m, The Book of Birds, an anthology of bird-related poems, edited by Leyland and Lebkowitz, will launch. The Canberra-Nara Sister City 30th Commemorative Anthology, Poetry Leaves, will launch on Saturday, September 23 at 1:30 p.m. at Generator Gallery at Belconnen Arts Centre. It presents tanka, short poems in a traditional Japanese form, written by poets in Australia and Japan. The event will also include a presentation by Noriko Tanaka on Manyushu, the oldest anthology of tanka, and a demonstration of manyo costumes. This month at Manning Clark House Poetry, on Thursday, 28 September at 7 p.m, Canberra-based poets Jen Crawford and Paul Collis and Melbourne-based Rose Lucas at the Manning Clark House, 11 Tasmania Circle in Forest. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is Murray Pariah's interpretation of Johannes Brahms' Piano Sonata No. 3 in F minor. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Art Sound FM, your music and arts companion.